This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Our discussion of artificial insemination is a specific medical question for ethics today. I want to consider various objections that have been given against the use of artificial insemination. The first objection that I think we can dismiss fairly quickly is the objection that claims that artificial insemination donor, which will be the key to, donor is going to be the focus of most of my remarks. There aren't many people who have difficulty with artificial insemination husband. There it just seems that the medical technician was overcoming some kind of biological problem, and there aren't the complicated ethical issues pertaining to the husband's contribution of semen as there are with donor's contribution. Now, people have said that artificial insemination donor is, quote, the acme of the depersonalization of sex. The acme of the depersonalization of sex. I think the response to that should simply be one real big question: why? Why is this depersonalizing sex? I mean, it may very well be that a husband and wife continue to have normal sexual relations, even though when it comes to the successful fertilization or the insemination of the wife, that there has to be some medical technology that is used. So it doesn't seem to me that the depersonalization of sex is an appropriate way to describe artificial insemination. It's more a medical procedure. I would use here the analogy of a surgical operation that enables a couple to conceive when there is nothing intrinsically wrong with the surgical operation itself. Should we say that we should never have surgical operations when the operation is intended to enable people to have children? Now, I don't understand at all why that depersonalizes sex. Of course, in our day and age, I'm not sure that sex shouldn't be a little depersonalized in view of the overwhelming personal interest people are taking in it and almost being consumed by it, but that's another matter. The second argument against it is something of an aesthetic argument. People will say that a clinical procedure here is contrary to the dignity of man. There's just something that's really contrary to aesthetic principles in having a clinical procedure used. Man is dignified. Man has this dignity from God, and to use a clinical procedure doesn't comport with that dignity. But again, I would appeal to the analogy of the surgical operation that enables conception by a couple. Why is it that we accept surgical operations, but we don't allow clinical procedures like artificial insemination? Well, we come to heftier argument, turn to the Roman Catholic Church, which has taught for years now that artificial insemination is against nature. Against nature. And of course, this argument depends upon the Roman Catholic concept of natural law. And we have to ask ourselves whether natural law is, as it's understood in the Roman Catholic Church anyway, whether natural law is a sufficient foundation for ethics. What do we mean by natural law? Do we mean statistical averages, so that something's against nature when it goes against the statistical norm for how things operate or are done? Well, even to buy that, which is the most obvious interpretation of natural law in the Roman Catholic setting, even to buy that argument is to commit the naturalistic fallacy. Now, the way things are is not necessarily the way things should be. I've yet to hear a Roman Catholic argue against the cutting of a cancer out of a person on the basis that that's contrary to nature. I mean, the way things are is not always the way things should be, and therefore we have the right to interfere in what is the statistical norm for the operations of nature, to go counter to nature. We remove weeds, and we homogenize milk, and we cure polio, and all of that's contrary to nature. Moreover, we should remember that when the Roman Catholic speaks of things being against nature, often the Roman Catholic is committing what is called the fallacy of reification, treating nature as though nature were some kind of entity or substance or person that could be dealt with individually. Nature is really just a metaphor or a word, a summary word for a number of other things that are taking place. Well, the next argument of some substance is the argument that artificial insemination amounts to adultery. And it amounts to adultery, we are told, as suggested by Dean Matthews in the 1948 publication Artificial Human Insemination. It amounts to adultery because it is the surrender of the reproductive facilities to another. The surrender of the reproductive facilities to another. My response to that is that that is a highly contrived definition of adultery. The surrender of reproductive facilities to another. After all, if a woman has an operation on her reproductive facilities, has she surrendered them to another, namely the surgeon? Is that adultery? Well, that would be improved, I guess. The argument would be improved to say surrender of reproductive facilities to another for the sake of reproduction. Well, of course, the doctor is doing the operation for the sake of reproduction. Well, for the sake of reproduction by the two people involved. But obviously, there's no person involved in artificial insemination donor. The woman doesn't even know the donor. So there's no personal relationship. And all I'm doing is showing you, as hard as you try, you can't come up with a very good definition of adultery that includes artificial insemination. And certainly this 1948 attempt is contrived. Sadly enough, in our own circles, Dr. J. Adams has done the same thing in his recent book on a potpourri for Christian counselors. He deals with artificial insemination, and he says that it is somebody intruded between the husband and the wife in their sexual relations or for the sake of reproduction, and that this intrusion into the marital relation amounts to adultery. Well, that word intrusion and the idea of coming between the two people is so vague that all sorts of things would fit the definition that we wouldn't for a moment consider adultery, and all sorts of things that we would consider adultery don't even fit. After all, a man committing adultery in his heart is not coming between a husband and a wife. For instance, if a man lusts after another woman, and she happens to be married to a third individual, a second man, he has not come between them in any significant way at all. She may not even know she's being lusted after. And yet we would call that adultery, at least adultery of the heart. So these attempts, and sadly in this case, because Dr. Adams usually does such good work, these attempts to make artificial insemination amount to adultery are, I think, singularly unconvincing. After all, there is no copulation involved in artificial insemination donor. There's no broken faith between husband and wife, unless, of course, the woman is doing it apart from her husband's permission or knowledge, and I'm not considering that kind of situation. And there's no lust. In Matthew 5, Jesus makes it clear that lust is at the heart of adultery. Some forms of adultery proceed to the outward expression, but it's adultery nonetheless when it's just in the heart. And consequently, lust is crucial to all forms of adultery. Well, in artificial insemination, there's neither copulation, broken faith, nor lust. So in a biblical sense, it is not adultery. Another argument used against artificial insemination is that it involves masturbation. That is, artificial insemination by a donor in particular means the donor is going to engage in a masturbatory act in order to donate the semen that will be used for the insemination of this woman. And in answer to that, we need to observe just on a factual basis that masturbation is not necessary to artificial insemination, that sometimes the semen can be collected after a marital act, a normal marital act. Semen can be collected by aspiration on the part of a doctor by means of massage of the prostate gland, and consequently masturbation need not be the case. Now, I fully admit that that is probably in 99.9% of the cases the way that it is collected, and that because it is the simplest procedure, the less complicated way to gain the semen. All I'm pointing out is that from a moral standpoint, it's not necessary. Moreover, some people would say that masturbation is justifiable when... Yes, sir?
This is a factual question. Is it possible to collect it through a prostate? I mean...
Yes, it would be. Yes. The question was whether you could collect semen through a prophylactic device, and you could. Now, some people would add that masturbation is justifiable when it's necessary and it's directed to a procreative end. For instance, the Archbishop of Canterbury's commission in 1945 came to that conclusion that artificial insemination that utilizes masturbation would not be condemned because the masturbation is directed to a procreative end. Now, this is interesting, because while most Christians are condemnatory of masturbation, I myself am, the fact is that there's very few convincing treatises written anywhere that show how the Bible condemns masturbation. I think the best that can be found, at least for my reading, has been J. Adams' polemic against masturbation. And Adams' argument, the central thrust of his argument, is that sex is supposed to be other-oriented and not for self-gratification, and therefore masturbation is excluded. Now, I think generally that's a very good argument, and it ought to be used with our young people and other unmarried people, and sometimes married people, I guess, to point out that masturbation is not God's will and contrary to that will. But you see that even in the case of Adam's argument against masturbation, that masturbation for the sake of procreation, masturbation simply for the sake of providing semen so that one's wife or somebody else's wife, a grieving party might be able to have children, would not be necessarily an act performed for self-gratification. In fact, I suppose one could imagine, although I don't know enough about the psychological dynamics of it to be an expert, that one could imagine somebody being fairly proficient that doesn't engage in a great deal of self-indulgence with respect to the masturbatory act. And so, if nothing else, a stronger polemic against masturbation will have to be raised. And I'm not suggesting it's impossible. I would like someday to write on that subject, because I think, although Adam's argument's a good one, an even better one should be developed and probably can be. But all I'm pointing out for your information is that not everybody would agree that masturbation is wrong in such a circumstance. And I'm adding this much, that technically it's not necessary to engage in masturbation to collect the semen necessary. So we move on to the next objection. And the next objection is that adoption should be enough for any couple that cannot have children, that adoption should be sufficient for anybody who is barren. And therefore, artificial insemination is not necessary, since adoption could fulfill the same end of providing children. Of course, the problem with this is that adoption is not readily available for people today. If you know much about the adoption situation in this country, it's very difficult to get adoptable children placed in your home, and therefore, even if adoption should be the alternative, statistically, it's not always available. Moreover, even when adoption is available, it's not always emotionally satisfying to the woman who wants to bear her own child. And I have known and can imagine further cases of couples that would be far more satisfied to have a baby through artificial insemination than to adopt, since, one, the woman has a desire to carry her own child, and the couple can say that at least this child is one-half genetically theirs. Okay, and there may be a greater emotional satisfaction even for the husband to raise his own wife's child, genetically hers, even though he doesn't know the donor and so forth, than to simply have an alien brought into the family. J. and D. Anderson, in fact, when you read that book as a supplement to my lectures, and in some ways standing over against what I say in my lectures, J. and D. Anderson suggests that if children are unavailable for adoption, the Christians should just accept that as a situation coming from God's providential hand. In this particular case, although I usually enjoy and profit from reading Dr. Anderson, in this particular case, I wonder if we wouldn't liken him to Elkanah of the Old Testament, Hannah's wife, who seems to be singularly obtuse about the emotions involved here and the motivation of people. He says, well, children are unavailable for adoption. Well, then just say that's providential and go on with your life. Well, just imagine the reductio ad absurdums that are possible from that view of prayer and providence. you're counseling with somebody who doesn't have a job or has lost his job, and he doesn't have enough food to feed his family, and say, well, now look, just accept it as a providential thing from God's hand and go on. Well, none of us would take that approach. We'd say, no, you have to try even harder. Unemployment and the supply of food for your family are grave problems, and you don't just accept them and just acquiesce in the problem. Why should we acquiesce in the problem that there are children unavailable for adoption? Moreover, Anderson says it's difficult for him to believe that the maternal instinct cannot be satisfied by adoption. He says he just can't really believe psychologically that a woman couldn't be satisfied by adopting another child. Why couldn't the maternal instinct be fully satisfied in that situation? Well, I'm not going to reply to this at length because it doesn't require any lengthy reply. It's just he needs to get out into the world and find out, as a matter of fact, in all sensitivity, some women are not satisfied by adoption. Now, somebody could argue, well, they should be. But I'm not sure why they should be, given what God has built right into the created order in terms of the desire to procreate and to replenish the earth. Barren women, after all, are made joyful mothers of children, according to the psalmist. And then Anderson proceeds to another form of argument. He tells us that an ethical judgment cannot be based simply on what is desired. An ethical judgment cannot be based simply on what is desired. And I'd like to quote him here from page 49 of his book. Okay, the strongest plea put forward in defense of AID is the plight of those married women who long for children but whose husbands are sterile. Repeatedly it is said by such women and on their behalf that what they need and desire above all else is to have a child of their own. Nothing else in the world will satisfy them. We need not affirm once more the profound compassion which this frustration must evoke, but our concern at this point is to answer the question whether such a desire, one which impels a wife to become the mother of a child who is not her husband's, but some other and unknown father's, is in strict truth inordinate, one which exceeds the proper bounds of desire. There are some whose sexual impulses might be similarly described, but that is no defense in a court of law, nor are we supposed in the eyes of the public at large. We are all, without distinction, required to restrain our desires, however imperious. On what rational ground is it urged that while sexual desires ought not to be indulged at will, parental desires may be? And are the results of indulgence in the latter likely to be quite different in their total effect on the personality from those which are known to follow in the former? If we persuade ourselves that because we want a thing so much, it must be right for us to have it, do we not thereby reject in principle, though perhaps unwittingly, the very idea of limitation, acceptance of a given natural order and social frame, in a word, of the creatureliness of man? There's such an incredible logical confusion in this argument from Anderson that I wonder if he didn't, if he wasn't somewhat pressed for time when he was writing these lectures at this point, because certainly, with a lawyer's mind and a judge's caution, if he reflected on this, he'd see that he's misunderstood the whole point of the appeal to desire. If a woman says, "Well, imagine we go to lunch today," and let's imagine we go to the pizza parlor and somebody orders a salami sandwich. Okay, now you're sitting there at the table while everybody else is having pepperoni pizza, and you say to the salami sandwich orderer, "Why did you order a salami sandwich?" The person says, "Well, I just had a desire for a salami sandwich." And then you reply, "Since when is desire a foundation for making an ethical decision?" Well, the person would probably look at you as though maybe you'd had a few too many beers at lunch as well. I mean, what's wrong with you? That isn't at all what he was saying. And when somebody suggests that they want to pursue artificial insemination because of a desire to have their own child, or a woman says she wants to bear her own child, she doesn't suggest at all that desire is the moral foundation of what she's doing. That's simply the motivational reason for what she's doing. She's not saying that all desires are all right, I have this desire, therefore it's all right. I mean, that's not at all the argument. Desire is indeed normatively, I'll get it right, from the standpoint of the norms for ethics, it is irrelevant. Yet desire is a legitimate motivation to do something unless it is prohibited. In a very real sense, you see here, the whole question is, what is your outlook on life? The broad issue is, where is the burden of ethical proof to lie? Are things generally evil until they are justified, or are things generally allowable until they are shown to be wicked? Now, Anderson, although I don't think he's consistent with this in all of his writings, at this point, Anderson's assumption is, well, something is wicked until you can show a good reason for the desire. And so if you appeal to desire, I mean, we don't approve of homosexuals engaging in the kind of sex acts that they do because they desire them. Well, of course we don't. But the reason for that is not because they have a desire for them, it's because that's an illicit desire. And we know it's illicit because God's word is revealed so. And my own approach to the scripture is that the Bible presents most everything as good, or at least adiaphora. And then the Bible adds, but you should, you know, watch out for this, watch out for that. That the prohibitions are given against the general backdrop of the goodness of creation, and in general, the goodness of what men are engaged in doing. Their hearts may not be good, their hearts are bent and directed against the Lord, but the, you know, sorts of activities that are possible for human beings, and the sorts of things that are in the world, are generally good, and therefore the burden of proof is to show that something is wicked, rather than to show that it really is all right. After all, if you order strawberry pie for dessert tonight, I would not be on very good grounds to say, now you give me a moral argument for why it's all right to eat strawberry pie. The response very naturally would be, well, why would you assume there's anything wrong with it? And that's the way I respond to Anderson's argument here. Why does he assume that artificial insemination is wrong? Isn't that what we're supposed to be finding out right now? Rather than just assuming it, he ought to be giving us some reason for it, and I don't see that he's given us a reason. Okay, finally, the argument, there's a whole host, a syndrome of objections that are raised against artificial insemination that arise from the circumstantial, psychological, and social dangers that it represents. And let me just give you a few of these. First of all, there's the problem of sentiment reversal. Sentiment reversal. Okay, the husband says, oh, I want you to have this child through artificial insemination, and I'm really with you in it. But then he changes his mind after the woman has born the child. That is, his sentiments reverse on the subject. And that certainly is a complicated situation. There's the problem, some people have said, of the donor's uneasiness about whether he hasn't met his children on the street, even though he doesn't know they're his children. The problem of unwitting incest when you have sperm banks and all the rest. The danger that the sex ratio in society might be affected if people can make such choices. The problem that unmarried women might become mothers through artificial insemination, or scheming women might get men to marry them on the threat that this man has really brought forth a child, even though she got the child through artificial insemination. The problem of exploitation by doctors, psychological problems having to do with secrecy and a sense of guilt in engaging in this. Question of legality. Is the child legitimate? Who owes parental support to the child? What are the inheritance rights of the child if it can be proven that the child rose from somebody's sperm who becomes later wealthy? These sorts of difficulties are raised persistently, and I'm not going to take the time and a short amount of time we have to deal with all of them. I want to point out that they are all circumstantial problems. Yes?
Deal with circumstantial.
Yes, I plan to deal with that when we discuss in vitro fertilization. Now, all of these are circumstantial dangers of a psychological or social sort. The legal problems I've mentioned are not insoluble. Even J.N.D. Anderson, who is more competent in that area than I am, even he admits that these legal problems can be dealt with. It's just a matter of rewriting laws of legitimacy so that it takes account of this. And we must remember that abuse does not rule out a proper use of anything. You think of the people who condemn all consumption of alcoholic beverages on the solid platform that alcoholic beverages are abused. And that is a solid platform. They are abused. So that doesn't prove that the proper use of alcoholic beverages is immoral. It only proves that the abuse is immoral. And if there is a problem of sentiment reversal and unwitting incest and all the rest, those would be abuses, circumstantial problems that need to be dealt with. But they have to be dealt with on their own. The problem is not with artificial insemination itself. And besides, most of these arguments, these circumstantial, psychological, social dangers, most of these arguments based on such circumstances actually prove too much. for what they prove is that adoption is also wrong. And what if a husband and wife agree to adopt a child, and then after the adoption takes place, the husband changes his mind? Well, you have sentiment reversal there, too, don't you? And we can go through the rest of the list with this counterexample. For the most part, adoption, if you believe that adoption is morally acceptable, then I'm beginning to wonder why you should disagree with artificial insemination. Well, now, J.D. Anderson does raise one situation that has to be dealt with that adoption doesn't touch. He says, what if the wife should ever turn on her husband in a case of discipline of the child or something and say that this child is uniquely her own and thereby claim possession of the child? Or what if the husband should reject responsibility, saying, well, it's not my kid anyway? Well, it seems to me the same argument could be used against remarriage in a very proper setting. Let's say that, you know, you have a Christian couple and the husband dies and the wife is left with the children, and then she remarries another man, and then this man, the potential is there for him to say, well, they're not my children anyway, right? Well, we wouldn't argue against remarriage on the basis of this circumstantial abuse. And so I don't think Anderson makes a very good point here at all. And so when all is said and done, we've gone through seven major arguments, and I've yet to find a good argument against artificial insemination. Yes?
It seems to me even in that last category, any child born that way is implicitly adopted.
Yeah, and that, I think that's the way you handle the legal problem, too. I think in the courts, they should simply take it for granted that artificial insemination is a subclass of adoption. It's a biological, in fact, I'm getting into my argument here, but I'm going to say it's a biological extension of adoption, that's all. Yes?
Second question, Rush Dooney draws conclusions from biblical law regarding affinity, especially our confessional statement, which is up for grabs. Do you have any comments on that?
No. I usually like to say something, but I think I'm going to be over my head if I get into that right now. Well, if there is no case against artificial insemination, is there a case in favor of artificial insemination? Somebody could say, well, now what good argument could you offer for it? And I'd like to suggest that one can be devised, and I'm going to set this forth now. Okay, first of all, artificial insemination, the way I'm arguing for artificial insemination is presupposing that proper conditions have been met. That proper conditions have been met. And there are three conditions, at least, that I would lay down. One, artificial insemination should only be performed within monogamous marriage. I think it's interesting, just a quote Anderson uses on page 51 from Huxley. Julian Huxley hailed with joy the fact that the perfection of birth control and the still more recent technique of artificial insemination had opened up new horizons for men and women, quote, to consummate the sexual function with those they love, but to fulfill the reproductive function with those whom on perhaps quite other grounds they admire. As you'd expect, outlandish ethical opinion from Julian Huxley, we get another one. Huxley says, well, this is great. Artificial insemination allows us to have children, offspring from those whom we admire, but then we can have sex with those whom we love. That is, he wanted to separate the loving context from the reproductive context, and I don't for a minute accept that. Artificial insemination must be within the context of monogamous marriage. Secondly, it can only take place with knowledgeable consent by both parties. Clearly, we wouldn't believe a doctor should inseminate a woman without her knowing it. You can imagine a woman being in the hospital for another reason altogether and having to be sedated or actually anesthetized, and the doctor, knowing of her psychological problems and distress over not having a child, might artificially inseminate her just as part of her stay in the hospital without her knowledge. We wouldn't agree with that, and even more, we wouldn't agree that a woman, a wife, should engage in the procedure without her husband's full knowledgeable consent. And then thirdly, we would add that it should only be performed by a responsible doctor, a healthy donor, and all other such conditions pertaining to the actual physical circumstances of the insemination. Okay, so if there is no unacceptable risk that is known, and it's within monogamous marriage with knowledgeable consent by responsible doctors, healthy donors, and all the rest, then I think a case can be presented, yes?
Would you add another condition of the donor to be unknown?
I think that's a negotiable. Because while I can't imagine psychologically anybody wanting to know the donor under these circumstances, and I can imagine incredible abuses and almost inescapable abuses. I can't, on the other hand, come up with what might be considered a more inherent objection. Because if my objection is circumstantial in that nature, then I'll have to deal with somebody who counter-instances by saying, well, I know of a situation in an Eskimo culture where, as a matter of fact, knowing that it's your friend semen who is used, and that person living in the same community and actually knowing the child and so forth, wouldn't present any problems of interference or jealousy or competition or all that. Well, conceivably, there is a culture or a certain psychological makeup where that'd be the case, but I just have to admit, in my case, I just can't see it. Yes. Yes. Thank you. That's very good. And I have to keep that in mind because that's kind of a plank of my argument, that any argument that's used, try it on adoption and see if it works there. And we do believe in adopting sometimes when you know who the parents are. And so I suppose you can't absolutely and universally rule out knowing who the donor is, although I think it's highly dangerous to do so. In our culture, I'd virtually say it's prohibited. Okay, now my argument, having set down these parameters, begins with the analogy of the levirate institution in Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 and 6. Just to refresh your memories, Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 and 6 tells us, if brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no son, the wife of the dead shall not be married without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn that she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother that is dead, that his name be not blotted out of Israel. Okay, here you have a rather obvious illustration of sperm donation. Minimally, sperm donation. Where one man inseminates a woman, but the child is specifically and legally considered the child of the dead husband. Okay, so although she knows the donor in this particular case, it does seem to me that you cannot rule out as absolutely immoral sperm donation, at least in a circumstance like this. The child belonged to the dead brother, and thus the sperm donation was not itself immoral. Now, I did have somebody who heard me lecture on this once offer a rebuttal to this, which has given me slight pause, although I must admit not very much. But I want to be honest and at least let you know what the objection is. His objection was that I had not understood the levirate institution properly because this is not sperm donation, because the second brother, the living brother, the one who actually brings about the bearing of the son, that this brother is now married to the woman, and therefore it's just a question of husband and wife sexual relation, not sperm donation. However, the legal rights of inheritance go to the child. The child's legal inheritance and name would be tied to the first husband, and that would be simply a social convention. As you can see, the difference between that interpretation and mine is whether the brother who inseminates the woman marries her. Sadly enough, I suppose, the language of the passage is open for interpretation at that point. I have always understood the levirate institution as being a localized duty of a brother to his dead brother's wife. Actually, it's a duty to his dead brother, but performed with his dead brother's wife. And that after he raised the child, that would put an end to his obligation and to their relationship. However, this other person is assuming that he must now marry and keep her to wife. I don't believe, at least the research that I've done after that objection was raised, has not satisfied me that it's very easy to tell. The language is perform the duty of a husband. Interestingly enough, he takes her to wife to perform the duty of a husband. That isn't the ordinary language used for he takes her to his wife. And one can imagine, although if it is what God wants, we clearly are not in a position to criticize. That would be the last thing a theonomist would want to do. But in the process of trying to determine what the scriptural text means, I think we should remember that there's some real obvious abuses possible and some real inner family problems if a brother wants to go marry a woman and all of his single brothers, or at least the next kin to him, his single brothers, should have some say-so in who he's going to marry if they are going to be stuck with marrying her later, possibly. And I've never thought that those really were problems since they didn't have to marry her. Go ahead.
I think the book of Ruth indicates what the younger brother can do if he doesn't want. responsibility. I also think that political proofing takes marriage itself. I don't think that invalidates the point, the analogy that you're making, to say that a marriage is involved.
Well, the argument from the person who raised this was that you don't have a donor of sperm, you have the husband's sperm being used, and therefore the idea of donation is invalidated. And how would you respond to that then?
I suppose I wouldn't make the analogy at the point of donation, but at the point of raising a child who's understood to be that of another man for legal purposes.
Okay, well, now does that, that at least supports adoption? Now, does it go further than adoption? I'm just playing the part of the critic. I don't buy this. In the first place, I'm not sure that he had to be married, but even assuming that he did, would we say that it only supports adoption, or does it also support artificial insemination? Not sure. Okay, well, that's something that you're going to want to study out further. My own opinion at this point is that the living brother had to perform the duty of a husband to this woman, and that after he raised up a child to her, that they would not have been considered married any further. That would be something that she could choose, or it's certainly true that he could have performed the duty and then taken care of the remaining marital obligations, as it's been suggested according to the Book of Ruth. Now, the next step in the argument, the last step in the argument, as a matter of fact, is that artificial insemination is nothing more but the extension of adoption into the biological sphere, or if you want, and I'm not saying this tongue-in-cheek, but in one sense, you could consider it just a very, very, very early form of adoption. What is being adopted is the sperm in this particular case, rather than a developed child. But in principle, what's the difference? And in fact, isn't there some advantage to the idea that it's not really adoption, it's a halfway step to adoption? The husband is adopting the child, but the wife is her child. It's also half somebody else's child, but so what you have here is a case that stands midway between adoption and a biological bearing of children. And if adoption is acceptable, and obviously the biological bearing of children is acceptable, why wouldn't the halfway measure be as well? It's just adoption with a biological feature to it. The disanalogy, of course, is that in the case of adoption, you have a child that's abandoned in one form or another, or orphaned anyway, and you don't have that in artificial insemination. You don't have a child that has had to go through the trauma at whatever point in his or her life of being abandoned or orphaned. It seems to me rather strange for somebody to say, well, it's perfectly all right to have adoption if the child's gone through this experience, but it's not all right if from the very outset, from the very conception, if you will, the child has always belonged to this mother. So the more I think about it, the more it seems to me it's obviously acceptable. The donor, in this particular case, is merely helping to overcome a medical problem, even as I might try to overcome a medical problem for my brother by donating one of my healthy kidneys to him. Would it be immoral for him to accept my kidney to overcome some medical defect? Why would it be immoral for a woman to accept some donor's sperm if that will enable her to bear children? Okay, so let's imagine a best case scenario here, just to kind of cap this all off. Let us imagine that you have a Christian couple who know a Christian doctor who is in connection with a Christian donor, and they all are motivated out of love and to seek the glory of God, and that the donor is a married man who, with the knowledgeable consent of his wife, engages in a marital act with her and collects, either through the use of a prophylactic or other methods that are available, the semen from that act and goes through whatever medical procedure necessary to keep it viable. And then the Christian doctor, for this Christian couple, with their knowledgeable consent and their utter dedication to the child that comes from this procedure, then inseminates the wife, she bears the child. The two couples don't know each other, and the child is treated just like any other adopted child by the husband, and the woman has the satisfaction of at least biologically bearing her own. Now, at that point, I'm just wondering where the objection would come in, apart from contrived definitions of adultery, natural law, and all the rest. Okay, do you have any questions? Want to pursue this quick?
The question of unwitting incest, would you say that that's something that we just ought not worry about because incest involves intent? Or would you suggest that secret records be kept by the government of all donors and children, so that when a person is married, they check with this government agency and they're told you may or may not marry so-and-so?
Yes, that's a very good question. First of all, from the normative standpoint, and then I'm going to deal with the consequentialist standpoint, which is the second part of your question. From the normative standpoint, it's my belief that incest was forbidden because of, as you put it, the intent. That is, having a desire for somebody within your own family. It's an illicit desire, and that's what makes it wrong. There shouldn't be this kind of union within certain lines or certain boundaries in the family. And consequently, although we know of medical problems that arise from incest as well, that would have been kind of a side benefit, a health advantage that comes from the law, but it's not ever presented as a matter of health, you know, so that you'll have good, strong children who don't have bleeding problems and all the rest, and you're not going to have incestuous unions. No, there's something wrong about uncovering your sister's nakedness, and it's from that standpoint that it's forbidden. So normatively, I would say we shouldn't worry about it. But now let it say that the medical field has shown that incest is of really tremendous proportions of threat to the health and well-being of a society, then I should think that it wouldn't be all that difficult to establish an agency that could keep records on whose sperm has been used with which women and the children that come from them. And there could be a rather secret, not secret to the public, but public doesn't have access to the information to keep it up. You can imagine all sorts of stories being built on that, how people would be bribed to tell them who the connection is and all that. But again, that'd be a circumstantial abuse. Yes.
Even then, it would be the government's they couldn't tell them just when they get married, would they?
The question is, then the government still wouldn't be in a position to tell people they couldn't get married, by which you mean couldn't use this sperm, couldn't bring together this woman and this sperm. Well, that raises an interesting question, whether the law of incest in the Old Testament should have been understood in terms of who you're raised with, or in a strict biological sense, who is your bloodline. And that catches me off guard. I'm trying to think. In the case of an adoption, for instance, would it still have been incest? I think it would have been. It's legal lines, at least. The question is it also bloodlines? What if they weren't? If you knew that this was your blood sister, I think it would have been immoral to marry her. And I think the government, as a matter of fact, could, for public health reasons, forbid that so-and-so's sperm be used with Mrs. So-and-so because of the incestuous health problems. Again, they wouldn't be doing it from the standpoint that it's prohibited on a normative basis, but rather on a consequentialist basis that it will lead to effects which are forbidden. That is, it would be an unacceptable risk to the child that would come from that union. Well, that's a good question to consider. Other questions on artificial insemination?
Is there any reflection upon the virgin birth issue?
Not really, because although there have been crude conceptions of the virgin birth throughout history, that is something of an embarrassment, I'm not at all convinced that the virgin birth should be seen as involving semen of any sort. In some miraculous way, Mary was able to bear the child Jesus humanly. His human nature, of course, is, in a very physical sense, derived from his mother. However, that isn't an ordinary human birth. And as we will see in a little while, genetic engineering has made possible virgin births anyway. So I'm not sure that the virgin birth historically would help us on artificial insemination. It might help us on another question, though.
Kenneth, we've gotten off the incest just for a moment. I'm wondering, most of our states and our civilization have civil laws against incest. Do you think that's biblically warranted? Is it the proper province of the state?
Well, yes, in that incest was punishable by the state in the Old Testament, then it would be the proper province of the state today to enforce laws against incest. Let's go back. I know that our time is short, and I think it would probably be unwise and not in the best interest for our film audience to try to just begin genetic engineering. Since that's a very complicated subject, and you want to begin a new tape with that. So let's just rehearse the principles that we've used here and then maybe call an early end to this lecture. I began by telling you that we have principles that have to be respected as we approach these medical issues. God is the author of life. He alone has authority over life, but man is his image, has a special authority, as well as a special value and care, and therefore man should be a steward over life issues. He has authority in them, contrary to the vitalist. He has accountability to God, because this is still God's territory, and there are limits that we want to recognize that medical science will have. We've seen a divine mandate for childbearing, contrary to the threat of overpopulation that's used today, and we've noted the centrality of the home and the family. So that when we come to artificial insemination, I do believe we should have hearts that really do resonate to the bitterness of soul of women who cannot have their own children and desperately want them. Impotence and sterility in the male, or the lack of, well, some physical problem that keeps semen from penetrating into the cervix of the woman, are reasons, medical reasons, why artificial insemination might be necessary. There's the threat of genetic defects to be taken into account. And then this open question about what about separation for a time. Maybe if we have a minute here, I should just comment on that. My personal feeling is that that's an illegitimate reason to engage in artificial insemination. And that, I suppose, would be based not so much on some absolute that we can find in the law of God, but rather on a consideration of the consequences of this. None of us believe that it is a healthy situation. It may sometimes be unavoidable, but nobody would consider it an acceptable or happy situation that a woman who has just had, say, a little child loses her husband in an automobile accident. Okay, we would say God by his providence and with the sustaining help of the church, the woman can get through. So it's not really unacceptable, as I had said a second ago, but it really is sad and it really is less than desirable. Now the whole question is, if we see that and admit that nobody should long for that situation, is it really right to set up the circumstances, the potential, for that same outcome coming about? If a man's going off to war, and the woman says, well, even if you were to die, I'd like to at least remember you by some son or daughter that you would bear in your absence. Wouldn't we be creating a situation where the woman has to raise the child on her own? Yes?
Yes, but your understanding of the left right, that's it. In other words, it seems to me that there might be some equity in the leverage before I can give couples handling.
Yeah, that's a very good counter-illustration. I hate being caught in reductios because that's my key philosophical tool, but I think that is a good one. At least on my understanding of the leveret. Of course, I could escape the reductio by changing my interpretation, but that's not good hermeneutical procedure. Okay, well anyway, after we raised that question about separation between the couple as a reason for artificial insemination, we looked at various objections ranging all the way from the aesthetic objection, this clinical procedure just doesn't comport with man's dignity, down through natural law arguments to the contrived argument against it as adultery, a consideration of whether it involves masturbation, and certain circumstantial, social, or psychological dangers. My positive case rests on the proper conditions being met, the analogy of the leveret institution, and then the whole, if you will, categorization of artificial insemination as an extension of adoption into the biological sphere. Now, the acceptance of artificial insemination, interestingly enough, I've given this lecture or something similar to it at a number of places around the country now, and it really meets with mixed response from general audiences. I am gratified that most people that I would consider well-studied in the scriptures, seminary students, pastors, and that sort of thing, have not had much difficulty with it. They found it interesting, maybe a little eye-opening. It's helped them to take a new perspective on it, but not a whole lot of resistance to it. But in some places, and I don't know if there's a geographical difference, in some places there is still a real emotional prejudice against it. I don't know whether that arises from the soap opera use of the technique or just what it is, but I want to at least warn you of this, that the fact that we haven't found good reason against it, and maybe have found good reason in favor of artificial insemination under the proper conditions, you should be sensitive that in our general evangelical culture, it is still not well received by large numbers, and we have to be, I think, winsome in our presentation of the case for it. Strangely enough, just about the time a couple of years ago I started studying this in earnest, the Lord brought into my life three or four cases where I actually had to counsel about artificial insemination donor. And I'm really glad that I had that opportunity to study this because it's at least given my counsel some firm footing in what I say to the couples. And so I dare say you'll run into that situation too. And all I'm cautioning is that you pursue it with the kind of sensitivity that should characterize a pastor. Okay, let's take a break.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.